Okay. We're still waiting on him to join.
Yeah, we'll wait. I like everybody be in before we get started.
Okay, they're all here. Over to you.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Okie dokie. Well, hello, friends. Welcome to this 85th webinar on the Secret Doctrine. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Mori Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress. All episodes of this, the Secret Teachings of All Ages, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you'd like to view. You can access any of these webinars on the homepage of Mori Federation in the upper left-hand corner. Well, a click will take you to a link. And this represents all the active webinar series going on at the time, including Dwayne Carpenter's series on Waking the Higher Mind. Okie dokie, this month in Old Diary Leaves, Colonel Olcott returns to London and is introduced to Annie Besant, a major figure in the Theosophical movement. So, could we get a reader to start?
Yes, sorry. For some reason, I had my video on. Okay. HPB greeted me warmly on my arrival in London, 4th of September, 1888, at 7 p.m., and kept me talking after the good old New York fashion until 2 a.m. I found Mrs. Annie Besant living in the house, having just come over from the secular war camp with bag and baggage. This was when her subsequent splendid career as Theosophical lecturer, author, editor, and teacher began, only 10 years ago. Does it not seem strange that she should have ever been anything else than a Theosophist? Is it not almost incredible that she should have once been so incredulous about our ideas, the existence of the great teachers, the possibility of infinitely extending human knowledge by widening the area of human consciousness? Strange that she should have been a materialist, hard as nails against the claims of spiritual existence and the promoters of philosophy.
Thank you, BL. Okay, another reader, please.
Okay, Vivian, can you read that for us, please?
One thinks, excuse me, one thinks she must have been but masquerading then in borrowed robes, while always in her heart a spiritualist. Certainly, that is what I saw in her at our first meeting. Despite her air of a woman of the toiling class, with her thick laced boots, her skirts somewhat shortened to keep them tidy when trudging through the muddy streets of the East End, her red neckerchief of the true socialist tinge, and her close-cut hair, in short, an Annie militant. Some of our people of the upper class in society were prepossessed against her, thinking that no great good could come from her importation of her fads and cranks into our respectable body. Some even protested to me against having her living at headquarters, as it might keep influential women away.
Thank you. Okay, and next up, reader, please.
Tom, can you read that for us, please?
But what I found in her written, in my diary of 5th September, evening of our first meeting, Mrs. Besant, I find to be a natural theosophist. Her adhesion to us was inevitable from the attractions of her nature towards the mystical. She's the most important gain to us in Synod. And note that her autobiography had not then been written blank cover the shine of her raven spirit within the day lamp of the body, as Maimonides puts it. She had not, I believe, made one public discourse in support of theosophy, nor had she said one word of the sort during the conversation between her and HPD and myself. But when conducting her to the door, I looked into her kind, grand eyes, and all this sense of her character passed like a flash into my own consciousness. I recall talking, taking her then by the hand and saying, just as at parting, I think you will find yourself happier than you have ever been in your life before. For I see you are a mystic and have been frozen to your brain by your environment. You come now into a family of thinkers who will know you as you are and love you clearly. Clearly.
Love you dearly. Yes, thank you, Tom. Okay. So, last time we talked a lot about Sanat Kumara. We began our last session by taking a look at Sanat Kumara called This Wondrous Being and the Initiator by HPB. Though in her time, Sanat Kumara's name was not yet associated with the Office of Planetary Logos. That didn't come until DK's work. We then learned that he is, quote, the tree from which in subsequent ages all the great historically known sages and hierophants, such as the Rishi Kapila, Hermes, Enoch, Orpheus, etc., have branched off. So I'm sure we could add to that list all the avatars that have made a significant difference in the countries that they incarnated into. HPB then tells us that he is the great sacrifice who sits at the threshold of light, which he will not cross into, and could not cross into until the end of his life cycle, because, quote, the lonely, sore-footed pilgrims on their way back to their home are never sure to the last moment of not losing their way in this limitless desert of illusion and matter called Earth. This is a tradition carried on by the Buddhists in reference to the Lord Maitreya, who is given the same idea, as where he stands on the threshold until the last sentient being crosses from the darkness into light. I'm sure that's also a veiled reference to Sanat Kumara. HPB then tells us that he is the, wait a minute, got ahead of myself. Next we learn that it is through the sons of God, under the guidance of this Mahaguru, that infant humanity got its first notions of all the arts and sciences, as well as of spiritual knowledge. We then took a look at a long footnote that details the evidence of the knowledge bestowed through these sons of God that work under Sanat Kumara, including the works of Vitruvius Pollio, whose work was an extension of the canon of proportion expressed in the temples of ancient Egypt and Greece, as well as the, quote, fanes, pyramids, cave temples, cromlechs, cairns, and altars of the ancients. We ended our last session with a pictorial essay of some of these ancient architectural wonders. And this takes us up to where we left off last time. Let's finish the footnote on the architectural wonders of the past. Could we get a reader for this?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
This is
Scott? Okay.
appreciative for posterity, says of those descendants. They used neither mortar nor cement, nor steel nor iron to cut the stones with. And yet they were so artfully wrought that in many places the joints are not seen, though many of the stones, as in Peru, are 18 feet thick. And in the walls of the great fortress of Cusco, there are stones of a still greater size. Again, the walls of Syene, built 5,400 years ago, when that spot was exactly under the tropic, which it has now ceased to be, were so constructed that at noon, at the precise moment of the solar solstice, the entire disk of the sun was seen reflected on their surface, a work which the united skill of all of the astronomers of Europe would not now be able to effect.
Thanks, Scott. Okay, first, this is what appreciative posterity says of those descendants, quote, "They used neither mortar nor cement, nor steel, nor iron to cut the stones with. And yet they were so artfully wrought that in many places the joints are not seen, though many of the stones, as in Peru, are 18 feet thick. And in the walls of the fortress of Cusco, there are stones of a still greater size." Here are two panoramic views of the walls of Cusco mentioned in this quote. And a close-up of the stonework. In 1553, the Spanish chronicler Pedro Cieza de León wrote the following. Could we get a reader? Take a look at this stonework here. Reader, please.
Yes, Magda, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The living rock was excavated for the foundation, which was prepared with such solidity that it will endure as long as the world itself. The work had, according to my estimate, a length of 330 paces and a width of 200. Its walls were so strong that there is no artillery which could breach them. The principal entrance was a thing worthy of contemplation, to see how well it was built and how the walls were arranged so that one commanded the other. And in these walls, there were stones so large and mighty that it tired the judgment to conceive how they could have been conveyed and placed, and who could have had sufficient power to shape them, seeing that among this people, there are so few tools. Some of the stones are of width of 12 feet and more than 20 long. Others are thicker than a bullock. All the stones are laid and joined with such delicacy that a rial, a Spanish coin, could not be put in between two of them.
Thank you, Magda. Okay, so the point of this footnote is that just a normal process of evolution from quote unquote primitive man could not have achieved societies that would have the knowledge that would be able to do this kind of work, and that therefore it was given to these peoples by avatars. You know, throughout the ages, avatars have always come in and taught a human being the ageless wisdom, plus very specific, in this case, canons of proportion, and also definite means by which to manipulate, in this case, stone. Many, I believe anyway, to have been lost, you know, such as the ability to cut stone with sound. Okay, next up, again, the walls of Syene, or Siene, built 5,400 years ago, when that spot was exactly under the tropic, which it has now ceased to be, were so constructed that at noon, at the precise moment of the solar solstice, the entire disk of the sun was seen reflected on the surface. Work which the united skill of all the astronomers of Europe would not now be able to effect. This is from Keneally's Book of God. Syene, now called Aswan, was famous for its granite quarries, which supplied the stones for many of Egypt's monuments, including obelisks and temples. Here's the temple of Philae at Aswan, made from the stone of this quarry. The Greek mathematician Eratosthenes used Syene to measure the Earth's circumference around 240 BC. He noted that at noon on the summer solstice, the sun was directly overhead in Syene, casting no shadow. Meanwhile, in Alexandria, 523 miles to the north, a stick placed vertically in the ground cast a shadow, indicating that the sun was at an angle. By measuring the angle of the shadow in Alexandria, approximately 7.2 degrees or 1/50th of a circle, and knowing the distance between Syene and Alexandria, something like 840 kilometers, Eratosthenes used simple geometry to estimate the Earth's circumference, which he concluded was approximately 40,000 kilometers, which is only, astonishingly, 75 kilometers less than the actual circumference. And that finishes the two-page long footnote, which is an elaboration on the results of the spiritual knowledge given humankind by the great ones. So we go back to the text, and could we get a reader, please?
Yes, Martha, can you read that, please?
Yes. Although these matters were barely hinted at in Isis Unveiled, it will be well to remember the reader of what was said in Volume 1, pages 587 to 593, concerning a sacred island in Central Asia, and to refer him for further details to the chapter in Book 2 on the Sons of God and the Sacred Island. A few more explanations, however, though thrown out in a fragmentary form, may help the student to obtain a glimpse into the present mystery. To state at least one detail concerning this mysterious Sons of God in plain words, it is from them, these Brahmaputras, that the high Dwayas, the initiated Brahmins of old justly claim descent, while the modern Brahmin would have the lowest case castes believe literally that they issued direct from the mouth of Brahma.
Thank you, Martha. Okay, first, although these matters were barely hinted at in Isis Unveiled, it will be well to remind the reader of what was said in Volume 1 concerning a certain sacred island in Central Asia, and to refer him for further details to the chapter in Book 2 on the Sons of God and the Sacred Island. Okay, these matters references the statement made before the footnote, which reads, "It is through these Sons of God that infant humanity got its first notions of all the arts and sciences, as well as of spiritual knowledge. And it is they who have laid the first foundation stone of those ancient civilizations that puzzle so sorely our modern generation of students and scholars." So here's one of the, Here's one of the above cited passages, this one from Isis Unveiled. But before we go there, I just want to point out that this sacred island in Central Asia was the an etheric, at an on an etheric level, and represented Shambhala. It's in the, I believe, in the Gobi Desert. But let's go ahead and read this and see what we find out here. Could we get a reader, please?
And Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Tradition says, and the records of the great book explain, that long before the days of Adam and his inquisitive wife, Hava, were now found but salt lakes and desolated barren deserts. There was a vast inland sea which extended over Middle Asia, north of the proud Himalayan range and its western prolongation. An island which, for its unparalleled beauty, had no rival in the world, was inhabited by the last remnant of the race which preceded ours. This race could live with equal ease in water, air, or fire, for it had an unlimited control over the elements. These were the sons of God, not those who saw the daughters of men, but the real Elohim, through in the Oriental Kabbalah, they have another name. It was they who imparted nature's most weird secrets to men and revealed to them the infallible and now lost word. This word, which is no word, has traveled once around the globe and still lingers as a far-off dying echo in the hearts of some privileged men. The hierophants of all the sacerdotal colleges were aware of the existence of this island, but the word was known only to the Java Alem, or chief lord of every college, and was passed to his successor only at the moment of death. There were many such colleges, and the old classic authors speak of them. Isis Unveiled.
Thank you, and Veronica. Okay, so, you know, he's talking about Shambhala. You know, there's hints all throughout this that show that it's not, you know, when he says the race that precedes ours, he's talking about the race that HPB introduced that came with Sanat Kumara. Not, and she says, not really a race at all, but a group of high initiates who came into being through Kriya Shakti, and that would. This would be a description of that group of people, you know. Hints like could live with equal ease in water, air, fire shows that they were, you know, that they had their existence on the higher planes, you know, having unlimited control over the elements. They were the sons of God. So this is that group from which the great avatars emerged, you know, at given intervals in order to reinitiate a root race with the ageless wisdom teachings. Any thoughts about this? I just love this passage. It's absolutely beautiful. Much here. Okay. So next up, to state at least one detail concerning these mysterious sons of God in plain words, it is from them, these Brahmaputras, that the high Dvijas, the initiated Brahmins of old, justly claimed descent, while the modern Brahmin would have the lowest castes believe literally that they issued direct from the mouths of Brahma. So the Brahmaputras, which means sons of Brahma, incarnate at the beginning of each root race in order to establish a lineage through which the ageless wisdom can be dispensed. The quote unquote high dvijas or dvijas were here told, descend from this lineage. Next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes. Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. This is the esoteric teaching, which adds moreover that, although these descendants, spiritually, of course, from the sons of Wilden Yoga, became in time divided into opposite sexes as their Kriya Sakti progenitors did themselves later on. Yet even their degenerate descendants have down to the present day retained a veneration and respect for the creative function and still regard it in the light of a religious ceremony, whereas the more civilized nations consider it as a mere animal function. Compare the Western views and practice in these matters with the institutions of Manu in regard to the laws of Grihastha and married life. The true Brahmin is thus indeed he whose seven forefathers have drunk the juice of the moon plant, Soma, and who is a Trisupana, for he has understood the secret of the Vedas.
Thank you. So first, this is the esoteric teaching, which adds moreover that although these descendants, spiritually, of course, from the sons of Will and Yoga became in time divided into opposite sexes, as their Kriya Shakti progenitors did themselves later on, right? So on page 293 of this volume, HPB defines Kriya Shakti as, quote, the mysterious power of thought, which enables it to produce external, perceptible, phenomenal results by its own inherent energy. The ancients held that any idea will manifest itself externally if one's attention is deeply concentrated upon it. Similarly, an intense volition will be followed by the desired result. A yogi generally performs his wonders by means of Ichit Shakti and Kriya Shakti. So from this definition, we might hypothesize that the sons of Will and Yoga used Kriya Shakti to project themselves into incarnation. And that's a scientific description of the immaculate conception. For the rest of humanity, the division of the sexes happened during the middle of the third root races. Both these forms of incarnation are described in stanza 7, verse 27, from volume 2 of the Secret Doctrine, which we'll get to in about 30 years, which states, the third race became the Vahan of the Lords of Wisdom. It created sons of Will and Yoga. By Kriya Shakti, it created them, the Holy Fathers, ancestors of the Arhats. You can see the close tie-in with what we're reading right now. These sons of Will and Yoga may have their origin in the second manifested hierarchy called the Divine Builders, which, as you can see over here in this last column, uses Kriya Shakti as the, quote, materializing ideal. Next. Yet even their degenerate descendants have, down to the present day, retained a veneration and respect for the creative function and still regard it in the light of a religious ceremony, whereas the more civilized nations consider it as a mere animal function. So HPB here describes three levels of being. First, the sons of Will and Yoga, also called sons of God, and Brahmaputras, which means literally the sons of Brahma. This is the agency of the Brahmic impulse. Second, the spiritual descendants of these sons of Will and Yoga, also called Dvijas, which were the initiated Brahmins of old. And finally, this second group's quote unquote degenerate descendants, degenerate here simply meaning a further descent into form, who we're told still retain respect and thus some understanding of Kriya Shakti, the original creative function, and show this veneration in their religious practices, such as the pouring of milk over a Shiva lingam, which represents the divine creative power, or Kriya Shakti. Next, compare the Western views and practice in these matters with the institutions of Manu in regard to the laws of Grihastha and married life. Okay, the institutions of Manu, also known as the Manu Smriti, is an ancient Hindu text that outlines various aspects of daily life, including the laws and duties of a householder, the Grihastha, and married life. For example, householders are encouraged to engage in charitable activities, support religious institutions, and participate in community life. Next, the true Brahman is thus indeed, quote, he whose seven forefathers have drunk the juice of the moon plant Soma, and who is a Trisuparna, for he has understood the secret of the Vedas. So, seven forefathers having drunk the juice of the moon plant Soma signifies a lineage of spiritual purity and ritualistic adherence, an unbroken lineage. Soma is a sacred plant used in Vedic rituals, and its consumption is symbolic of divine connection and enlightenment. The term Trisuparna refers to a Brahman who is well versed in certain specific sacred texts, as well as to those texts themselves, which are made up of portions of the Rig and Yajur Vedas. Yeah, Tom, go ahead.
Can you put the earlier text?
Sure.
Do I read right now that those sons of will and yoga who created by Kriya Shakti, they also were divided in the opposite sexes?
They also were divided. Let me reread this. Yeah. Here we go. Yeah. Yeah, that's curious, isn't it? This suggests to me the what is called the fallen ones, which is those who willfully incarnated in order to generate the next root race, right? And of course, when you willfully incarnate, then you would do so on the physical plane, which would then divide you into opposite sexes. But this would be through their own choice and volition that they would do this. You know, this gets into, you know, the idea of those sons of God who the New Testament mistakenly calls, you know, fallen, the Luciferian groups, you know, but which indeed incarnated for the sole purpose of initiating a new root race. But here,
yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, you can't do it from on high, you know, in order to actually build in those higher qualities of the next root race, then they would have to literally enter into the form world in such a way that they could influence the beginning of that root race. Yes, Nadal. Sorry, BL, I'm kind of preempting you here.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Yes, Nadal.
Nadal, you had your hand up and then you lost it. Did you have a question?
Yes, I was trying to get unmuted, sorry. So would you say that they would have to divide themselves into opposite sexes in order to create the Lemurian race? Since the, as I understood it, at Lemurians were when the sexes kind of split, but to do that, these higher people, wouldn't they have to divide themselves?
Yeah. Well, you know, before that time, the way human root races were created was through projection. It's this, they were called chahayas, these downward projections into denser matter. Of course, that wasn't full material density. It was etheric level density. So that was the means of procreation. So they were literally images of their higher counterparts. And those would have been these same sons of Will and Yoga, but they wouldn't have had the degree of evolution. What was the purpose of those early root races is to perfect the form aspect, right? So it wasn't until the third root races that dense physicality was achieved. And the final stage of that in the middle of the third root race, I think the fourth subrace of the third root race, then it moved from the egg-born, which would have been an etheric level reality, to a dense physical splitting of the sexes, right? Divided into opposite sexes. So my guess is that at that point, that there would be a key group of the quote-unquote sons of Will and Yoga, who literally incarnated, and they would have done that through Kriya Shakti, but nonetheless, they did incarnate into physical form, right? And in order to, now whether they themselves procreated in order to infuse the sub-race with the necessary qualities to have their form elevated to the point that the Manasaputras could overshadow them, you know, that's not described. It's, you know, it's, they don't say whether they actually themselves procreated or whether they had some other way of influencing the sons of men in order to raise their vibration to that point. It's, you know, it's hard to say, but they did themselves, you know, yet it's described in passing here. In other places, it's also described, and it's a big part of the second volume. She really gets into the nature of this period in the evolution of humanity during the second volume. Okay.
And Barbara's got her hand up.
Okay, Barbara?
Yes. So when Asanat Kumara is ready to initiate another root race, it sounds like he is pulling in more assistance from on an extra planetary basis. So the Sons of Will, it sounds like, aren't just products of the previous root race, but they're bringing in something new. So I wonder if that point, if these Sons of Will are coming from other planets in the solar system, is there a large then cooperation that happens?
Yeah, we don't know. They could be advanced humanity from the moon chain. You know, for instance, the Buddha came from the moon chain. It's speculated that he took his third initiation on the moon chain and came into the earth chain as one of the great initiates, you know, whereas the Christ started in Lemurian times and actually advanced all the way up through the sixth, and is about to take the seventh on Earth. It could be moon chains types. It could be. I don't think there is any kind of hard wall, between the planets in terms of the humanity that could participate in this process. Because, we learned that on this seven cosmic paths that one freely engages and reincarnates in other schemes in order to learn the lessons needed to advance and these higher levels, and that are only available in certain planetary schemes. So, the verse could reverse could just as well be true, that there would be members of humanity from advanced humanity in other schemes. It's not, we're not told. At least I haven't run across any direct reference in either HPB or DK material that describes this, but it certainly could be.
There's some indication that Venus is more advanced, has been somewhat influential for Earth.
Well, yes, indeed. And that would be the first candidate, wouldn't it? Would be literal incarnations of Venusian humanity in order to raise the vibration of some subrace, like in this case, we're talking about the third root race, right? It's important, though, to remember that Sanat Kumara came to us through the Venus chain and Venus globe, and from that Venus globe to the Earth globe in this fourth chain, not directly from Venus. Now, how he, what his previous development was and his association with Venus before that, before he came to the Earth chain from the Venus chain is not made clear. But he also came with a group of initiates, which is what this whole section of the secret doctrine is describing. And these would have come with him through the Venus chain and the Venus globe to this Earth globe. What their direct association with Venus is difficult to say, but it would sure hold that there would be members of the Venusian humanity that would be involved in seeding, SEED, seeding a new root race in Earth's humanity. It certainly seems to me, it just seems logical. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's so helpful.
Anyone else? It's a fascinating
Yes,
topic.
we have a number of comments here. So Magda says the sons of God of the Aryan race have their home in the Gobi Desert on the mental plane. Was the Atlantis race had home in Mato Grosso, Brazil, on the physical plane? The Lemurian lords before that were the lords of the so-called infant humanity on the physical plane. And apparently, this is schemes from Philip Lindsay.
Okay, thank you for that. I can't directly comment on Philip Lindsay's interpretations, but we certainly know that the sacred island, the White Island, that is in the quote unquote Gobi Desert, obviously on very high subplanes of the etheric physical plane, because DK. Not DK. Sanat Kumara is incarnate etherically, and he stands at the center of Shambhala. So that would suggest that Shambhala is, I would guess, on the first and second, the atomic and subatomic subplanes of the physical plane, and of course, it has its correspondences on the high on the four cosmic etheric subplanes. Yeah, anyone else?
Yes, one more from Vivian. She says, I wonder if, had they not descended into denser matter, these beings would have needed to create slaves to do their bidding. Obviously, something that we are trying now to avoid.
Interesting comment. I'm not sure exactly what you mean. So are you saying that if these sons of God hadn't incarnated, that they would have had to create physical beings to do their work? I'm not sure just what you mean by slaves.
Yes, Francis, I'm not absolutely sure myself, but the understanding that these gods, these higher beings, then they use the word degenerated. I think Tom brought that up, you know, the feeling that how can they degenerate and come so low? But had they not, there would have remained this separation between those creatures or animal creatures who would then have been turned into slaves. I'm actually thinking that the thing that came to my mind was the Hebrews and the Hebrew slaves leaving Egypt that we all learn about in primary school. How come that they made slaves of the Hebrew people? It
Okay.
just came together from that point of view.
I see. Okay, the use of the word degenerate here has nothing to do with what we normally think of as degeneracy. This just means more physical, right? Because the Kriya Shakti progenitors their descendants were, why am I having trouble saying this? It's a simple thought that they were more, for instance, they lost the power of Kriya Shakti and became regular descendants, that is, physical descendants of what was initiated by these sons of God through or did
Francis, we just lost you. Maybe I got lost. Did everybody else just miss hearing Francis say that?
Yes.
I cannot
He was
hear him.
lost.
We cannot
Okay.
hear. Me neither.
Okay. Francis, we lost you there for a minute. Are you back?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, a little sign came up. It said my internet connection was weak. So, did I just cut out for a bit?
Yep, almost, well, 3 or 4 minutes. We missed almost everything you just said.
Okay, I'll recap because I was kind of stumbling along anyway, which is that there is this group of sons of will and yoga who are able to project themselves into incarnation, right? Their descendants did not have that power. They did carry the qualities that were projected into the new root race, but the term degenerate has nothing to do with our usual use of the word degeneracy, right? Suggesting that there's something wrong with the normal process, right? But just simply that they are more physical plane oriented, in this case, would have lost the ability to project as their as the sons of God were able to do through Kriya Shakti. That's all it means. It wouldn't have anything to do with slavery or anything like that. Okay. I don't know if there was another question in there, Vivian, about Egypt slavery or but that's not part of this idea.
Thank you, Francis.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, so we are here, I believe. Can we get a reader, please? That was a great conversation. It helped me articulate some ideas around that as well. Just what was the nature of that of the role of these sons of God once they did incarnate, and what was the effect on them of having incarnated? Okay, up next, reader, please.
Nadel, can you read that for us, please?
And to this day, such Brahmins know that during its early beginnings, psychic and physical intellect being dormant and conscious still and consciousness still undeveloped, the spiritual conceptions of that race were quite unconnected with its physical surroundings. That divine man dwelt in his animal, though externally human, form, and if there was instinct in him, no self-consciousness came to enlighten the darkness of the latent fifth principle. When, moved by the law of evolution, the lords of wisdom infused into him the spark of consciousness, the first feeling it awoke to life and activity was a sense of solidarity, of oneness with his spiritual creators. As the child's first feeling is for its mother and nurse, so the first aspirations of the awakening consciousness in primitive man were for those whose element he felt within himself and who yet were outside and independent of him.
Thank you, Nadel. Okay, so first and to this day, such Brahmins know that during its early beginnings, psychic and physical intellect being dormant and unconscious and consciousness still undeveloped, the spiritual conceptions of that race were quite unconnected with its physical surroundings. Given the context thus far established in this section, the Brahmins, quote, early beginnings is probably referencing the middle part of the third root race, during which the separation of the sexes occurred. Since at that time the Manasaputras had just overshadowed, we're looking at 21 million years ago here, had just overshadowed, and through that overshadowing, re-endowed the fourth kingdom in nature, quote, psychic and physical intellect was as yet dormant and unconscious, and was yet dormant and consciousness still undeveloped. This period marked the beginning of humanity's exploration of the not-self. It was all brand new. The spark of mind, the overshadowing allowed for the development of the spark of mind. But the physical intellect was still dormant. In fact, DK says that it took about 3 million years for there to be enough presence of mind, literally, that the hierarchy could be established. It's very slow process of coming into mental activity at the beginning. Okay. Next. That divine man dwelt in his animal, though externally human form. And if there was instinct in him, no self-consciousness came to enlighten the darkness of the latent fifth principle. Well, this is pretty unequivocal. It describes the indwelling jiva who had yet to develop the spark of manas, which is the fifth principle, here implanted by his or her overshadowing soul. Next. When moved by the law of evolution, the lords of wisdom infused into him the spark of consciousness. The first feeling it awoke to life and activity was a sense of solidarity, of oneness with his spiritual creators. This sense of oneness with his spiritual creators was innate, inherent, and was not to be consciously realized until first, the development of the emotional sheath during the Atlantean root race, and second, the development of manas during the fifth root race. As HBB describes here, it was an innate, natural feeling of connectivity with the source of its being that wasn't impeded by mind. or for that matter, by the development of an astral body. It was just the natural sense of, well, she says here, of oneness, of solidarity with the source of its being, which would be that projecting soul, the overshadowing, Manasaputras. And finally, as the child's first feeling is for its mother and nurse, so the first aspirations of the awakening consciousness in primitive man, meaning third root race man, were for those whose element he felt within himself and who yet were outside and independent of him. So this references a recognition of and a response to one's inner imprisoned soul, the soul in incarnation, whose higher counterpart is a solar angel on its own plane. Any thoughts or questions about this? It's a unique passage. Yes. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Nadal.
Francis, would you think that this consciousness state we're talking about here, would this be mass consciousness or even before mass consciousness?
Yeah, it would be instinctual consciousness, which evolves into mass consciousness. And I think mass consciousness is very much informed by instinctual consciousness, though the kind of instinct that we're talking about, that the beginning of the middle of the third root race, which was overshadowed by Manasaputras, that's unknown to us now. The humanity is, in other words, the mass conscious individual today would be far, far more developed than this level of instinctual consciousness. Because there's no development of manas whatsoever. You could say it's just a direct instinctual awareness, not unlike that of animal man, but the spark of mind has been planted, but as yet, just beginning to unfold. Okay, anyone else? All right. Okay, next up, can we get a reader, please?
Charlie, can you read that for us, please?
Devotion arose out of that feeling and became the first and foremost motor of his nature, for it is the only one which is natural in our heart, which is innate in us, and which we find alike in human babe and the young of the animal. This feeling is impressible. Instinctive aspiration in primitive man is beautifully, and one may say intuitively, described by Carlyle. The great antique heart, he exclaims, how like a child it is simplicity, like a man's it is in its earnest sublimity, and its depth is depth. Heaven lies over him wheresoever he goes or stands on the earth, making all the earth a mystic temple to him, and earth's business all of a kind of worship. Glimpses of bright creatures flash in the common sunlight. Angels yet hover, doing God's messages among men. Wonder, miracle, encompass the man. He lives in an element of miracle. A great law of duty, high as these two infinitudes, heaven and hell, dwarfing all else, annihilating all else. It was a reality. It is one. The garment only of it is death. The essence of it lives through all times and all eternity.
Thank you, Charlie. Sorry. So first up, devotion arose out of that feeling and became the first and foremost motor in his nature. For it is the only one which is natural in his heart, which is innate in us, and which we find alike in human babe and the young of the animal. So it's a very instinctual level feeling that you could say she's tying to the source of our being, you know, to our souls, that trust, that feeling of solidarity with the one who sent us forth, you could say. And it's unconsidered, right? It's just a pure sense of devotion. I've written here, devotion is, quote, natural to his heart because it is a fundamental quality of the soul reflected into that aspect of the soul that is imprisoned in form. Like attracts like. And through occult magnetism, the soul on its own plane draws the jiva ever upwards towards itself. This quality of devotion was particularly developed during Atlantean times. But the innate devotion didn't require an astral body. It was a fundamental part of instinct. You know, instinct is not just about being able to respond to danger, but it also includes this quality. Next, we have the beautifully written quote from Thomas Carlyle's Past and Present, which captures the feeling of wonder often found in the myths and paeans of ancient cultures. First, the great antique heart, he exclaims, how like a child's in its simplicity, like a man's in its earnest solemnity and depth. Simple because people were unconsciously immersed in whatever form of ageless wisdom was being practiced by their culture. And now I'm not referencing the third root race reality because, you know, we have no way of knowing, but it, you know, it here he's, I think he's referencing the historically ancient cultures such as those of Greece, Egypt, and India. So in from that point of view, participants of those cultures were just immersed in whatever form of ageless wisdom was practiced by their culture. The earnest solemnity of an adult came through a natural commitment to the spiritual beliefs that ruled all aspects of their lives. The dissipating quality of modern critical thinking, which reflects on whether a teaching may or may not be true, was not, by and large, practiced. It was accepted, and not just accepted, but believed to be true. Next, heaven lies over him wheresoever he goes or stands on the earth, making all the earth a mystic temple to him, the earth's business all a kind of worship. To the ancients, nature and God were one. A flowering plant might represent the presence of a goddess, not as a metaphor, but in actual fact, as surely as a temple dedicated to her, a rainstorm, a passing flock of birds, or the onset of winter were all expressions of deity, all seen as that. One of the ancients might have proclaimed, Isis is. Next, glimpses of bright creatures flash in the common sunlight. Angels yet hover, doing God's messages among men. Notice the lack of condescension in Carlyle's words. He doesn't say, like a modern anthropologist might, they mistook natural phenomenon for the presence of supernatural beings. Indeed, as theosophists, we know that bright creatures exist. So why wouldn't they, quote, flash in the common sunlight for those who have eyes to see? Next, wonder, miracle, encompass the man. He lives in an element of miracle. Deity is woven, or was woven, in all nature and in every aspect of daily life. Thus the quote-unquote mundane is imbued with spirit. I see a hand.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, it's sorry. Thank you. Yes, you know, this reminds me of, you know, the indigenous peoples of the Americas still see and experience the wonders of nature as gods and goddesses and living beings. And, you know, what's interesting to me is that we're so devolved and so vulnerable now. Our nation has so lost its way, and finally it's on its knees and open to, you know, Native American knowing in a way that it hasn't been before, you know, that has been demeaned before, or pushed aside, or, you know, in part because it's been tainted with alcohol and trauma. And what I see is, and even in the past few years since Standing Rock, you know, the protests there where people came from all over to join the Native Americans and the water protectors there who were attacked by the police and the corporations, I see a new respect rising out of that whole understanding that hasn't been here before. And it will not only heal the whites in our nation, I believe, but it will also heal them, because they've totally been so demeaned that they lost self-respect. Yeah. And I can see the activism. Like, I tried to reach out to them for some activism, you know, because I'm an urban forest activist, and there was no response over years. And I see an awakening in them that relates to this that you're talking about, that they're going to give us a gift that they had never forgotten, this lore.
Yeah, really beautifully said. I studied with an Apache shaman once, and I came into some limited awareness of the depth of the spiritual tradition, at least among the Apaches. And I think this is shared among, you know, many, many different tribes in the U.S. I also live in an area where we have a very powerful, possibly the most powerful Pueblo in among the Pueblo Indians, which is an unbroken tradition of, they've never lost their shaman. And so it's a profound form. And what you said about the integration of spirit and nature lies at the root of their form. You know, I think that they're very much in touch with the Devalords that oversee different groups of natural reality, like, for instance, the deer and the bear, and that the shamans actually really do get in touch with these Devic beings, which allows them to provide for their tribes. You know, it's the opposite of an intellectual approach. It's deeply pragmatic, and yet it's incredibly mystical at the same time. Thank you for that, Om Swava.
Yes, this is Ariane. Can I just follow up with
one? Oh, it's Ariane. Yeah.
Yes. Just with one short remark in response to what you just said. So there's like an incredible patience and tolerance within the Native American community. Not everyone, but as a culture, like an acceptance of what is, and to see the spiritual in what is not, and also to even understand the law of karma, that things come around and come back to one. And And so the way they approach the what you said, spirit in matter, that they see the spirit in matter and how that relates to humanity's role on this planet, that we are here to spiritualize matter, that they already see that spirit is nascent in matter. It's, you know, it's like the polar opposite. They see that exists within matter as matter exists in spirit. And I just want to remark, I live in San Francisco, and in the last month since the presidential election where Trump won, I've lived in San Francisco for 31 years. There was both a 7.1 earthquake north of here. There was a tsunami warning, and there was a tornado warning in the last few days. And the reason I'm bringing it up is because, you know, from my understanding, from studying, you know, Benjamin Krem's work and such, that our negative emotions, including our fear and anger and concern about this time, disrupts the Devic realms. And we have to pull it together somehow within ourselves to understand our to be in right relationship to matter and to nature. And so we have to monitor ourselves really moment to moment. This is really, I'm remarking on this because I'm just really trying to goad everyone who's here listening, either on YouTube or in this class, that we are being called because the dark forces are on the move, and we need to double our efforts, which means something out in the world, because something is wanted from us, and also something is wanted for us, which is awakening, a heightened consciousness. So I just say that I know that not everyone's American in this room, but America is the problem, and we have to pull it together both as individuals and groups. And I know people may disagree with me. They're people.
Well, don't worry about that. You know, first of all, in terms of American, everybody comes from and has an indigenous tribes as part of their, you know, native heritage that just may have existed in an earlier time. But I couldn't agree with you more. And what you said is very, very shamanic, you know, that first of all, you have to take responsibility for what's going on and see the connections, you know. And I like that idea that the distress that was created, you know, in this presidential election, I believe too that it actually could reverberate into, you know, for instance, natural patterns like weather patterns, etc. You know, this is very, very shamanic, and yeah, I agree with you on that. Thanks for your input, Ariane. There's some really valuable thoughts there. Yes, Barbara.
So I think whenever there's a journey of a being, an evolution, but obviously there's a monad, and the monad is in some way we it's described as a spark of the divine. So it's with us the whole journey, and it's in every form and vehicle that we take. So even if the higher planes are not fully developed, I think that they're there. And what Carlisle is discussing, and what has been beautifully described, is that spirit will always call us to us from the form, through the form, and that will be throughout the whole of our journey, and that this journey is taking place within a larger context of the harmony of the spheres. And Pythagoras's work of the greater laws. So so whatever situation we encounter in the involution and evolution and forms of various kinds, the The true light of the absolute will is there. And we learn it has to be central. It has to be the absolute guiding light for us. We will have many dramas, many kinds of situations, and we need to use all of our higher principles for those. But all of that is taking place within extraordinary wisdom and divine love.
Thank you, Barbara. Absolutely. Very well said. You know, the monad is ever present, the spark within never is extinguished, never even dims. It's our relationship to it through consciousness that we're working to develop, right? So thank you for that. Okay. Next up, we're still in the quote from Carlyle, a great law of duty. High as these two infinitudes, heaven and hell, dwarfing all else, annihilates all else. So the law of duty expressed itself through the ancients' belief that they were one with the purpose expressed through nature. Through nature's outer expression, they didn't see themselves as different than this expression. And thus, one with the purpose of deity. Thus, life and duty were one. These two infinitudes are spirit and noumenal matter, which for human beings are experienced as the self and the not-self. The eventual sattvic or balanced recognition of spirit within the form will eventually allow a transcendence that annihilates the heresy of duality. Next, by saying it was a reality and it is one, Carlyle suggests that he's not just talking about how the ancients believed, but reveals that he himself recognizes their understanding of God and nature as truth. The garment is, of course, the physical body. The essence is what D.K. calls the life aspect, which permeates all form. So to me, this sentence really makes it clear that Carlyle deeply reveres the approach, the natural orientation of the ancient ones. Okay. Any thoughts or questions? The footnote referenced by the phrase, he lives in an element of miracle, states that which was natural in the sight of primitive man has become only now miracle to us. And that which was to him a miracle could never be expressed in our language. So, this is HPB's addition, her reflection on Carlyle's words. So one interpretation of this statement might be the natural framework by which the ancients understood reality included intercourse with the unseen worlds, the energy of which in their minds also permeated the seen worlds. For them, the mystery was everywhere present. Sunsets, dreams, the shape of a leaf, a vision of or visitation from the higher realms were all aspects of nature, which is God manifest, and of which they believed themselves to be an intrinsic part. So it wasn't miracle to them. I'm realizing I didn't address this. It says here, in the sight of primitive man has become only now miracle. It didn't stand outside of reality as a miracle might, right? It was but intrinsic to their reality. On the other hand, because this framework has been replaced by the scientific point of view in modern society, any phenomenon not recognized by science is now considered to be either an hallucination or a quote-unquote miracle. The subtext in both cases being that it is somehow unreal and thus not part of nature. And because we are circumscribed by this scientific orientation, modern humanity no longer experiences the wonder felt by the ancients when met with any experience, whether natural or supernatural. The natural being scientifically explainable and thus easily dismissed, and the supernatural being unexplainable and thus standing outside the parameters of nature, and therefore unreal. Only those who have made an effort to re-engage with the synthetic understanding of a God in nature can even begin to feel, quote, that which was natural in the sight of primitive man. Any thoughts or questions? Okay.
Yeah, I have a quick thought about that. There's just so much hubris in science, and that we treat in America science as a religion. We don't question the fact that it's really largely been infiltrated by, you know, commercial forces, that it's not pure science, you know, applied science and medical science and all that. It's hard to disentangle that. And for example, we don't have the means to measure nuclear radiation. Supposedly part of the role of the Space Brothers, the extraplanetary beings that are here now, is to, within karmic law, remove nuclear waste, which is not only poisoning our entire planet, not just from bombs and depleted uranium produced by dual nuclear power plants, but also that the nuclear power plants are all continuously leaking. We just don't have a theric site or the machinery to measure it. So they come in within the law of karma and they try to alleviate some of that waste. But we're also supposedly through that waste, which is going up to the stratosphere, endangering life on other planets. And so we can see, like, when there's a nuclear explosion or a bomb, like there was in Hiroshima, that it produces awe, because what it's doing is it's giving us a glimpse of a higher world, but it's literally renting the fabric of the planet, the sheath, the planet. And it does something to the other planets as well. And so we're becoming like a rogue planet, and the beings from the other planets are trying to help us, but we have to change our relationship to science, because science itself responds to, like, observation, the law of observation, which we understand as an esoteric principle from, you know, Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta and the Jains, meditation, that's a basic principle in the realm of science, that one observes, one repeats, one verifies, one hypothesizes, and one comes up with, from conjecture, observations about supposed reality. But what they don't recognize, in addition to the limitation of their machines and technology and measuring devices, which are just basically an extension of our senses, our eyes, our ears, and all that, you know, which again puts man as the center of the measuring instrument, what we don't realize and measure, recognize, that the consciousness of he who observes or she who observes impacts everything around it, including what is being measured. And so we have yet to even understand that. Right. And so all these things where we have to take a step back to understand what we don't know is infinite, right? Yeah. I mean, that can be a way of defining God. What we do not know is infinite, but also it
Oop, you cut out. You cut out.
What I said is, my last expression is, what we do not know is infinite. And that could be a definition of God, but it also is a definition of us. What we do not know is infinite. We do not even know ourselves,
right?
Let alone God.
Yeah, well, well said. I'll make one comment, which is that science and, you know, modern society is so invested in the scientific method that even when there's evidence, such as you were describing in terms of the efficacy of meditation, which is repeatable and therefore provable from the usual parameters of the scientific method, it's ignored because it in itself then disputes the circumscription of the scientific method itself. In other words, it reveals that which stands beyond the that which can be measured by science, even though meditation itself is repeatable. The effects of meditation is repeatable. So yeah, science is unknowingly prejudiced to its own limitations at this point. So, but I that's all I want to say on science at this point. But thank you for your input on that, Ariane. So in order to get a unified, and we'll end with this, to get a unified experience of this passage from Carlyle, I'd like to read it one last time. The great antique heart, he exclaims, how like a child's in its simplicity, like a man's in its earnest solemnity and depth. Heaven lies over him wheresoever he goes or stands on the earth, making all the earth a mystic temple to him, the earth's business all a kind of worship. Glimpses of bright creatures flash in the common sunlight. Angels yet hover, doing God's messages among men. Wonder, miracle, encompass the man. He lives in an element of miracle. A great law of duty, high as these two infinitudes, heaven and hell, dwarfing all else, annihilating all else. It was a reality, and it is one. The garment only of it is dead. The essence of it lives through all time and all eternity. It's a really beautiful passage. Okay. So that takes us to our next passage, and we'll leave that for next time. Dates, let's see, we're looking at the 27th of December is the next Treatise on Cosmic Fire, which is Friday the 27th. And then we go to the 5th of January for the secret teachings of all ages. And then we're into the new year. You can always go to moriafederation.com and find a calendar there if you're wondering when these dates are. Okay, that's gonna do it for today. Thank you all for attending, and we'll see you next time. DL had to drop out early. She's got a niece involved in a Nutcracker Suite production, so she's off to the dances. So much love to you all. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you all.